Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Ryan Fraser.
This is Troy Deeney.
This is Gus Boyett.
This is Don Hutchison.
This is Jürgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graeme Hunter.
Thank you, Jürgen. I travel to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast wouldn't happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graeme Hunter right now to join us, to become a socio, and to get every interview we produce without adverts, and before it goes out on the main feed, plus lots of bonus content, including the chance to put questions to our guests and to me via the monthly Q&A. You will also get bonus content every month, including the audio versions of my regular columns for ESPN. So do please go to patreon.com/Graeme Hunter and join the club, and get your family and friends to do so. Maybe even strangers in the street. Love you. So look, your eyes don't deceive you. When you clicked on, selected The Big Interview, I guess what you expected to get was The Big Interview, and you did. It's Graeme. Nice to have you back. Speaking about having somebody back, fantastic to have had Jamie Carragher back on The Big Interview, returning 5 years since he first appeared on our show. That day, he was just like Gary Neville, our first ever interview on The Big Interview. He was in Sky. He was preparing for Monday Night Football. We sat in a little recording booth, and I enjoyed it very much indeed. But I had the distinct impression that Jamie was thinking, what is this strange format? Who is this strange guy that I normally only see across the editorial floor on Sky Television? It was good. It was enjoyable. But I think he was still getting trying to take my measure. Well, he's done so since. We worked together in Madrid to interview Xavi Hernandez. That was great fun. And a couple of months ago, Jamie phoned saying, look, could you give me a little bit of your ideas and thoughts and information about the Wembley match, the Champions League final of 2011 when Barca beat Manchester United? I'm writing this book. So he did. He was very kind in terms of including my thoughts in the book. He sent it to me. I read it. It's very, very good. And it catches a particular fascination of mine in that now when I'm analysing games to try and write an article, or analysing games using Y-Scout or YouTube in order to better present on La Liga television, the rabbit hole, the warren of things that you can dive into if you're interested in retrospective analysis of matches, of themes, of moves. There's so much to discover there, including your misconceptions. Not only whether on the night in the hurly-burly you got something wrong, but also whether time has dimmed or even just taken and mangled and spat out your recollections. Jamie Carragher seized on this as a theme and put together his book, The Greatest Games, and we used that as a reason to get back in touch with him. So this episode, we'll talk about the concept of the greatest games, and it'll start with something very dear to his heart, because he was at Everton against Bayern Munich in the Cup Winners' Cup when Everton went and won that tournament. And it's a perfect example of how going back to something that was for him a cherished childhood memory, he found out very different things about the rough and tumble of playing not against Everton, but against that Bayern Munich, and how misconceptions about silky, poor old Bayern Munich were booted all over the park by Everton. Not a bit of it. So our talk is about that night, or those nights, one in Bavaria, one at Goodison, when Everton went through and knocked out a classic Bayern Munich side. But it's also about the art of punditry, talking about Andy Gray, Gianluca Vialli, to Jamie and Gary with Dave Clark, and originally with Ed Chamberlain on Sky. Listen to this episode, enjoy it. Buy the greatest games for the football fans in your life, either for Christmas or at any other opportunity. But also please check out our new YouTube channel, where you can find audio of all our old interviews, plus lots of video clips from more recent guests. You're going to enjoy Jamie Carragher, this time talking about his version of the greatest games. And there are some corkers in there. This is the big interview, and I'm quite pleased and proud to not only have a guest this afternoon from whom you're guaranteed intelligence and football character, but we're going back to our origins, because Jamie Carragher, as I've already explained to him this afternoon, featured in one of the early interviews, and I remember him sitting across the desk from me in a sound booth in Sky, and the words were good and the debate was good, but the eyes were saying, well, this is one weird cookie I'm talking to here. Hopefully over the years that feeling has been erased or developed, and for anyone who's able to look at this tape of the interview, this is Jamie's exceptional book called The Greatest Games. I'm not going to talk too much about explaining it, because he's going to do that for himself. First of all, Jamie, you're a popular and talented man. Thank you for sharing your afternoon with us, although I suppose of a Friday afternoon, week after week, you probably get that yearning to think, I'm going to give Graham a wee phone and just talk football with him. And thankfully, it's today we can actually do that job.
No better time and place.
No better people either. Jamie, the greatest games, first of all, so that I don't have to, explain to our listeners the concept of this book, handsomely produced and featuring, I think, 6 or 7 words from me. What was behind your idea to write this?
Well, I've always been a big reader of football books, and not necessarily footballers' autobiographies, even though, of course, I've read them. But I do read certain football books. I remember a good few years ago now, I read The Italian Job by Gabriel Marcotti and Gianluca Vialli. I've read a couple of football books by Michael Cox, who's, you know, really good analyst on football, and Mr. Zonal Markin. There was one, I think it was called Brilliant Orange or something about Dutch football.
It's a sensational book, yeah.
I've always read those type of books, and I've always thought I'd like to do a book about football, but not an autobiography, because I'd done one of those about 10 years ago. And I'm certainly not a fan of people doing 2 or 3 of them, as people do. So it basically come to me because of the work I do on Monday Night Football, analysing games, and on the back of what we've been doing with our own podcast, The Greatest Games, where we ask a guest to come on, and probably similar to what you do, and then at the end we ask what the greatest game is. And it was almost, why not let's look at some great games and give them the Monday Night Football treatment and really analyse them the way, you know, the game is now, with obviously interviews with the biggest people involved, and see what we could come up with. And, you know, we're quite pleased with it.
I'm going to list the chapters. They run like this, in order. Liverpool 4, Barcelona 0. Everton 3, Bayern Munich 1. Liverpool 0, Arsenal 2. Already you can see the skipping across generations, from the most modern to some of your youngest memories. England 5-1 in Germany. England 4-1 at home at Wembley to Holland in Euro 86. Liverpool 3, Everton 2. Manchester United 2, Bayern Munich 1 in 99 in Camp Nou. Liverpool 4, Newcastle 3. Manchester City 3, QPR 2. Aguero. Barcelona 3, Manchester United 1, which is the Wembley 2011 final. And, of course, in there, the climax, the centrepiece, AC Milan 3, Liverpool 3. Before we go into one or two of the specific chapters, Jamie, one of the things that emerges most quickly is this idea about unreliable memory, unreliable narrative, the way in which football matches sometimes on the night
and the day after get mistold or misseen. Of course, it leads to endless debate at the time. But legends grow. And the way that legends grow is obviously part of the way that football grabs your heart, because it isn't just the 90 minutes. You need heroes and you need villains. You need perceived flops, perceived brilliance. And I know that in starting out, and I think through it too, it was on your mind constantly. Am I going to look back and find that there were more warts than beauty spots? Is that true?
Yes, I think that's always the case. And I actually spoke to Teddy Sheringham about that, because I interviewed him for the 99 chapter in the Camp Nou and England-Holland. And he said he didn't like watching games back because he never played as well as he thought he'd played, and it almost ruins the memory. And throughout the summer, we all got very nostalgic because of, obviously, COVID and lockdown, and the old games were getting played. And he said one of the few games he actually enjoyed watching back was the Euro 96 game of England-Holland, really. So it was interesting that, because I always feel as a player, we come away from games and think we've played well, and other games we think we've played poorly. It's never as good as you think, and it's never as bad as you think when you look back at a game. But I think you're right. I think the narrative around football games a lot of the time revolves around the result rather than what's happened in the 90 minutes. And it was just really looking into that, really, and trying to, maybe if I can pick up a few nuggets and few things that are maybe, or certainly go against the grain of what the narrative is sort of years later, and maybe make people go back and watch that game and maybe change their thinking.
Was the most, I mean, you're a Liverpool man now. As you say in the book, it's well documented that you've had a change of heart and there's a before and after. But was the game where Everton eliminate Bayern Munich, having had them softened up 2 years earlier by Aberdeen, and that doesn't get enough play in the chapter, Gemma, I'm sorry to be critical at this early stage, but you do mention us. But was that the one where, because, you know, the memories that might have been dislodged in games you played in, whether that be in Munich against Germany, or whether it be Istanbul, those memories you could influence. You were a participant. But a memory that might be dislodged or besmirched when you're a kid with a bobble hat, for a certain part of the journey anyway, is that the one that you were most worried about?
Well, looking back at that, not so much. And the reason I say that is because I think what the great thing in the book is that, and whether, and I know it maybe upsets people from that era, and when I was speaking to Peter Reid and Andy Gray on the phone about it, the way football was played then, and certainly that Everton team, had a mixture of physicality, direct football, with good football. So in my mind, I don't think it's ever been shaped differently. That game is about basically bulldozing that Bayern Munich back four into the net, or almost into the Gladys Street, through set pieces, long throws, direct play from the goalkeeper. And so it wasn't so much that. The thing that was different that I found in that was that's the way that game's always been billed, you know, the power of the English and, you know, direct football. But Bayern Munich's first throw in of that game's a long throw. It's just little nuggets like that you see. And this was no shrinking violet Bayern Munich team. This was Argenteiler at the back. This is Pfaff in goal. You know, Leby in midfield. Some of the challenges that went on.
Flugler.
Yeah, Flugler. I mean, Andy Gray kicks him up the arse.
He lost his boot, I think, didn't he, as well?
Yeah. And but no, and also, it was good watching it also because of the fact that the way this game's been painted, it was a little bit more than that, because I think those type of coaches who we think of in, you know, certainly the 80s in England, is a bit, you play the same every week, you know, the same team, the same formation. There's no, you know, now we talk about, you know, tactics and systems and different players playing and rotation. But it was interesting speaking to Andy Gray, because I noticed it in the first half, how split Everton's two strikers were, Sharp and Gray. Normally you want two strikers together, combine, and I could see that in the tape. And he said when you were playing against the sweeper then, so it was a big thing from Howard Kendall to actually isolate defenders in wide areas, leave the sweeper alone without protection. So even then...
But let's stop, Jamie. Define what you mean by a sweeper, because I know, or I'm going to suggest that what you're saying is that they had three central defenders, one of whom played behind or in front of the two centre-halves. So you're actually talking about a sweeper in a three with two wide backs, aren't you?
Yes, that's what it was. It's not so much three at the back in a zonal sense. Yet this is, you know, defenders following strikers all over the pitch. So if Andy Gray and Graeme Schaap know they're getting man-marked, they're taking up positions so far away from each other, which basically means defenders are getting isolated and they haven't got cover, where basically the sweeper system is all about cover. Two men-to-men markers, going as tight as possible, and you always have that spare man behind. So if you stretch them across the width of the pitch, they're going to get isolated certainly a lot more. So even just picking up little things like that shows how much thought was going into games then.
And they change at half-time, what you described, because, you know, I don't want to overemphasise this because our listeners are quick, but what you've done is you've gone back and watched the 90 minutes once or a couple of times in each of the chapters, and therefore, and if I'm, you know, I don't want to betray too many of the secrets because I'd like people to buy this and read this, but you pre-note your conceptions, your ideas about the game before you see it again so that you can measure them up again, which I think is a really good technique. But you say that at half-time, they play slightly closer together, don't they, Graeme Schaap and Andy Gray?
Yeah, so they do. So obviously that was a tactic in the first half. It's maybe not working as well as they want, the 1-0 down, and maybe it's a case of actually, let's go back to our sort of way of doing things normally in terms, you know, they're attacking the Gladys Street end. I mean, the famous half-time team talk from Howard Kendall, that's all remembered.
Where he says what? You quote him?
Yeah, sorry. He's basically, the Gladys Street will suck the ball in for you. You know, that type of thing. So the Gladys Street for Everton is what the cop is for Liverpool. And
get it up there and the fans will draw it right in.
That's what it was. I mean, this is Bayern Munich. But at that stage, you mentioned Aberdeen before. But I think we looked at the stats. I think Aberdeen had been knocked out of European competition 5 years in a row, or 5 years out of six, by English teams. So Aston Villa obviously won the European Cup final. Aberdeen, Everton, I think Tottenham knocked them out along the way somewhere as well. So at that stage, English team's record, and especially not just in Europe, but against this Bayern Munich, they had real problems.
One of the things that has emerged already in having read the book and listening to you now, perception isn't always about things becoming wrong over the years. I think that stories get told about, like, for example, you've established the idea that what was said about Everton by Munich from that day onwards, when you knock them out and it's in the glory years of Everton, you're about to win two titles with a year apart, was that Everton were the long ball, hard merchants, and not enough was spoken about the fact that Bayern not only matched kick for kick, but tried to have it out with Peter Reid, and they were bashing into the back of Andy Gray's head. So they weren't angels. But is part of what you've discovered, or do you think, that over the years in Britain, the media that describe football, and I don't mean modern because I'm coming on to a supplementary, have maybe not understood football as much, and they paint it as theatre. They're always good guys and bad guys. The foreigners are often either cheating and dodgy because they're going down all the time, or they're beautiful and elegant and swaying and the ball moves and they're taller than us and their chests are puffed out and, man, look at that strip. Do you feel, because that's my perception, that has tainted the way that football matches have been described on the radio and television or written about over going back to the 70s and 80s onwards?
Yeah, I agree, Graeme, and I think when we get into debates even now about systems and tactics and what managers do, I think sometimes, even in this country, and I'm talking about punditry as well and ex-players, they don't enjoy it. It doesn't get the juices flowing. It goes over the head a little bit. They don't think the game is really about that. And I think that stems going back, you know, a long time when the narrative was always about the result. And even when you read our press, there's no real criticism or praise for managers in how they set teams up. I don't feel in this country, even to this day, it's all about the result. And the result just covers everything or masks everything, really. And I think there's a lot more to it than that. And I just think in England, I think with journalists or maybe press, and it's just the way we are, this is the way we are as a country, I suppose. But I think when you hear about managers going abroad, they say they get a lot more questions on, why did you play a back three? Why did you make that substitution? Why did you play him in this role? Why did you do this? And they almost have to explain the actual idea, the tactical setup. I got that a lot from Gary as well when he was in Valencia. That's what people would really home in on. That would never be a question for a manager here. You know, you'd never ask, if Jürgen Klopp went and played 4-4-2 rather than 4-3-3, I mean, people had mentioned it after the game, but I don't think it'd be a big debate with Klopp in the press conference. Why would you do that? What the extra man in midfield? What does 4-4-2 give you against this opposition? So I think as a country, we don't get as involved in the tactical side of the game. And that's what's something that really, really gets me going. And certainly in the job I do, and the Monday Night Football and the pundit, is why do teams do certain things?
May I tell you about another podcast? Yes, we believe in biodiversity. It's from the makers of The Big Interview, and it's called Between the Lines, the stories behind great sports writing. Every episode takes a classic sports book or outstanding piece of sports writing and examines how the writer crafted their story. This is a weekly show, and the series so far has featured documentaries on the miracle of Castel di Sangro and Andrea Pirlo's autobiography, I Think, Therefore I Play. There's also interviews with writers like Henry Winter, Simon Cooper, Andy Mitten, and David Goldblatt. This is Tim Parks on his classic tome, A Season with Verona.
The Bishop of Verona invited the citizens of Verona to burn the book because I'd put all the blasphemies in it. So that was obviously good for sales. You know, I was very, very pleased about that. I wish they'd done it. It would have been a happy memory. On the Cordoba, I would go to games. There would be loads of kids coming up to me saying, you know, I've never read a book before, but I really enjoyed this.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The listeners know, and I'm just stating for you, I'm not going to blow smoke up your arse, but you're involved in something which is changing that. And I want you to think honestly now about the football you watched growing up, which was presented as a package. Predominantly would have been whatever ITV's, I lived in Scotland, so we got different, but ITV had their version, Match of the Day is the more famous version. It was presented as highlights with almost no tactical analysis whatsoever. The highlights per se were presented as the most entertaining bits. So the other bits that might have led to them, not relevant. And for many years when Match of the Day expanded, I'm going to call players out, you don't have to join in. In my opinion, there was very little tactical work done by the Hanson Lawrenson era, in my opinion. Insufficient. I remember Luca Vialli, when he left Chelsea, saying, I'm going to go back to Italy, I'm going to work in television. He said, I'm going to do what Andy Gray is doing for Sky. This is obviously way back in the late 90s. Because in Italy, we only think about, why did that goal go in and the referee was rubbish or bent or whatever. He said, I want the debate to be opened up. And he was in Italy. Luca Vialli's mission was to go back and take what Sky was doing even then, before the days of you and Chambo and Gary and you being fixtures on a Monday night with Titi Henry. I want you to contrast, never mind talking about the quality of what you're doing, really the very fact that it's a staple part of the diet, and I know that our listeners, I know that they are voracious for the same thing that gets you going. The debate, our vocabulary's changed, Jamie. You know, across football appreciators, we might get it right, we might get it wrong, but the way in which we want to talk about football, positions, ideas, strategy, I don't think that's massively changed in the media, but I think the punters have changed. You have to talk about this honestly without me trying to make you bum yourself up. Don't you recognise the change in the way in which young footballers, say over the last 20 years, have grown up compared to how you and I grew up? You were a good athlete, you were a good football player, and you bettered your football career because you wanted to reread matches, read your position. So, okay, fine. But there are kids now who have grown up over 20, 25 years, and we'll see it in their play, who've had a completely different vitamin diet of football analysis over their lifetime. Don't you agree that's fundamental?
I totally agree. I really do. I mean, a big thing I always found when I just stopped playing was my son was at the Liverpool Academy, and that was taken over by the Barcelona influence, really. Rodolfo Borrell was there. And my son would come home to me and say, I'm playing number six, I'm playing number eight, I'm playing this, I'm playing that. And just these things started coming in. And you can imagine the reaction in this country when a young player says that and, oh, nonsense, this is this. And I just think that influence, you talk about players as well and the analysis that they get. I think the important thing, not important as so much, I used to always think it was almost like a weakness when I was a player where I couldn't identify where a player played. I used to think, well, what's his position? What does he do? But now that almost seems that it's like, that's almost like a strength now, where, you know, people do float in and out of different positions, and sometimes we see teams playing different ways with the ball, and then when without the ball, they're playing a different formation, and there's people in different areas of the pitch, and they're interchanging and moving. And I do think the understanding of younger players now, definitely in terms of what you're talking about, but I'm not sure if you just mentioned the punters, but I actually think supporters' understanding of the game now is a lot greater. And I don't know if that's just maybe down to social media, so we see it a lot more. But, you know, there's, as you said, you go on Twitter, every club has fan sites and podcasts, and everyone's talking about the game. And the information that they give, the people out there now, as a manager, you may not just get away with results. Before it was always, get results. Now supporters want to know, what's your idea? What are you trying to do? They're looking at expected goals. They're looking at how much possession they've had, how often they've been in the opposition's penalty area, and actually saying, well, we're winning games, but we're being quite lucky because we're not doing X, Y, or Z. Or the flip side of that could be, we're not doing so well, but you keep the supporters on side. Because now, I think their actual knowledge of the game and knowing when things are going well, and the actual absolute how much football there is in terms of Sky Sports News every day, podcasts, social media, going to the game, every game at this moment because of COVID's live on TV. I just don't think there's ever been more analysis. And it actually feels like it's changed a lot since I first went into punditry. That was probably 7 or 8 years ago. It feels over the last 4 or 5 years, it's certainly with supporters now and people on social media, it's going up and up, really. And it's difficult to keep up.
I love what you said. Now, I'm not Jamie Carragher. I've not done what you've done. But I think I've lived in Spain for a reason. I've listened, I've watched, I've benefited. I've changed my vocabulary and I've changed my understanding. You blink, miss a game, miss a decision. And the people that talk to me, either as socios, members of our podcast, or on Twitter, who follow Spanish football, they'll be like, this, I saw that. I said, you're like, I missed a week. And they're all over me. You have to be on top of your game, keep ahead of the people you're trying to communicate to, which is healthy.
No, I totally agree on it. And it takes me back. I treat punditry like I treated my career as a footballer, where I played at Liverpool all my career because I never gave anyone an inch. It was, I'm not saying I wasn't the greatest player in the world, but no one was taking me place. And it was always, I've got to keep going. I could never almost relax until it was finished. And I'm a bit like that with punditry, and I agree with you. If you don't watch a game or you miss the big incident, you feel like you're behind the curve. It's like you're almost playing catch up, trying to, you know, watch it, and it's moved on again, the narrative or whatever it may be. And that's how I am with punditry. I watch all the other shows to check what they're doing. I'm across everything as much as I possibly can to know. And it doesn't mean I'm then going to be right, you know, I can be right, I can be wrong, it's an opinion, but you can base your assumption on having really watched it and know exactly what's going on, what's getting said, read the room, what's the reaction to certain things, and then almost give your point of view. But no, I'm like that with pundits. There's new pundits coming all the time wanting to maybe take your place, or people will eventually say, oh, we've heard enough of that. And that's why I think in my role, it's very important. I want to say my role. I mean, there's everyone's role in punditry, whether you've been a player or a journalist. But I'm very mindful of the fact of never saying in my day. I think you can use experiences from your time, but almost never. I always think football's the best it is now. And in 2 years, it'll be better then than it is now. And the game moves on, and you look back at your own games compared to games now, it's much better, the football. And I think you've got to sort of keep up with how the game's moving forward and not sort of say, well, we did this and we did that. You know, it's when you talk, you see the goal kicks now. I mean, it fascinates me, goal kicks now. And that's like the detail I like to go into. But, you know, someone will lose the ball around the edge of the box, and then people say, oh, we never did nothing like that. But these managers aren't idiots. They're all doing it. There's a reason for it. Sometimes it's not going to work, but what are they trying to get out of it? So that's what I'd be thinking. You know, these managers aren't, you know. So don't be saying, oh, we never lost the ball around the edge of the box. Well, you're never going to lose it around the edge of the box if you kick it long. But there's a why. What's the reason? Why are we doing it? You know, almost get into that rather than say, this is wrong. We never did that.
Spot on. If you don't unpick it, if you don't work at the what is the chess game end game, then you can't decide, well, actually, I see what Nagelsmann and Bielsa and Sarri and Pep are trying to do with that, and I like the idea looking at it, but I don't fancy it actually for this squad, that player, this crowd. It's that, okay, some coaches will say, these are my principles, bollocks to you, I'm staying with the front. But if you don't try and unpick them, if you just do that, that's right, or that's fashionable, I must do that, or that's wrong, we didn't use it, then you're never going to work out, well, what's it for? And I think that, what's something for? And you caused me to go back, it's the last time we'll talk about the game that, well, the only game that's passionate to you as a fan. That Everton game, there's a eureka moment. I can't remember from the book whether you realised it on the night as a 11-year-old kid, I can't remember, but there's a eureka moment in your analysis when you're looking at, who is it, Eder, one of the centre-halves goes off with a bleeding nose. And I'd seen this at Pitodgi when Aberdeen got knocked out, Fergie's Aberdeen got knocked out by Hamburg, and we had a player off and we played on. And your point, I'll let you take up the narrative, your point is that I think Larrabee takes a free kick with Bayern still only having 10 men on the pitch. And from that moment, Everton possession of the ball, and they do certain things, and it's just not a very mature piece of thinking. And your analysis going back there reminded me of, you'd be analysing it exactly the same way today if you were on your legs with Dave Jones on Sky. Just detail that incident that I'm talking about that was so crucial to the tie.
Yeah, I mean, if we'd make a big thing of it now, if someone went off the pitch, you'd be well aware of it. I think probably even watching the football years ago, I mean, the commentator wouldn't even probably mention it. You'd almost not know that they were down to 10 men in some way, really. But you noticed that, I noticed that he went off. They then put a set piece in trying to slow the game down and maybe wait for the guy to come back on and help them. I think they take a free kick quickly. Before you know it, it's in Southall's hands. And Everton find themselves with long throws. Now, you're talking about one of the centre-backs. You know, three at the back, three dominant players. Again, you take advantage of that. Really, it forces the goalkeeper to come out the goal, Faf, to try and deal with it, because he knows the two defenders alone and the one man down can't deal with it. He almost ends up getting thrown into the Gladys Street, and there's an empty net, I think, for Andy Gray. But I just think at that time, it just didn't get mentioned. No one really spoke like that or went into that detail. Really, and that's what we wanted to do with games, and that was the oldest game that went back to 85 of me as a 7 year old. So it was just those things that I thought we'd be mentioning that and making a big deal of that, really. And game management,
there's a thorny issue now. I should look, because we've got social questions. Bet365, our sponsors, asked the Germany 5-1 game came after a low point for England, losing 1-0 at Wembley. Did he get a man goal? Did you feel a corner had been turned that night? You were on the pitch. As you say in the book, you had a beautiful, devastating 7-minute cameo defending that 4-0 lead. I'm stealing your words, but it's one of the best phrases in the entire book. So before you answer that question, there are a couple of more. And You know, we've got Merrin Myrtle we're going to ask a question from, Gareth Scriven, Jake Garlick. And Jake Garlick says, in terms of the 5-1 in Munich, what does Jamie think of Sven as a manager? What did the players think at the time about the tactics he used, whether they were the right ones for modern football? Does Jamie think that they underachieved or were unlucky to lose on penalties twice to a very good Brazil side? How much of a difference did injuries to key players make? There's a lot of information in that question. The sponsor's question was, after the 5-1, did you think a corner had been turned? Maybe the answers to both Jake and to 365 come in the shape of your deductions from that chapter, which is an extremely powerful chapter. And maybe when people read it, they'll find it the most surprising chapter, I think.
Yeah, I mean, looking back, obviously, it was a huge euphoria, the press, and, you know, beating Germany at a derby game, if you like, at that type of level. And when I look back at the game, it almost was a snapshot of why we didn't do well. I mean, that was a game that was, we should have been losing 2 or 3-1 at half time. I think when I say it gave us a snapshot of why we didn't do well, we gave the ball away so much in the first half. But don't forget, this is in the middle of a season. You're in Germany. It's certainly not baking hot. It's not in the Far East where I think that World Cup was. And you've got Scholes, you've got Gerard Beckham, three of the best passes of ball you'll probably see. But not necessarily the three passes you want together in the same team, because they all make the same pass, which is always looking for that 60-70 yard pass and diagonal ball over the top for Michael Owen. So it works a lot in this game, certainly more second half. But in the first half, the turnover in possession was the reason why we should have been 3-1 down, and almost gives you a reason why when you get to those summer tournaments, the turnover in possession was just far too much. And then you contrast that with players you know so well, Graham, of your Iniesta and Xavi's, very rarely played that pass. Very, very rarely. It was always what was the right pass for the team. It wasn't about the Hollywood ball, as we called it. As I said, these are three of the best technicians we've ever had and three great players. But that's maybe the makeup of that team and squad, whether it actually gelled together and worked together. And it was proven that it didn't really. In terms of Sven, I don't think I ever saw a team Sven picked and thought, what is that? I can't believe he's picked that team. Because you do get that with managers where they do something that you just cannot quite comprehend. But he always picked the obvious team, you think the best players, so you think nothing outrageous. But did he ever sprinkle a bit of stardust in any way as a manager with what he said or how he set up or throwing something different in a big game and tactically? No. I mean, he didn't. I find it difficult to criticise managers for two reasons. One, I've never been a manager. And number two, I always think when players criticise managers, I'm not a big believer in that, because I think the manager, number one, has got another 20, 30 years experience in football. He's managing, you haven't. So when I hear a player who's 25 saying, oh, the coaching's not great, or the manager's not this, or the man, I mean, I don't really listen too much. So I'm probably a bit nicer to managers than maybe other players are. But with Sven, I don't think there was anything he ever said to me, ever, in the time I was there, where I thought, that's interesting, or I've learned that, or that's new. Other managers I had, they'd always say something that make you think. Whereas Sven, it was very, very, very basic.
I've got to offer you something, Jamie, and I'm not causing an argument, but I want to relate what you said earlier on. You talked about understanding how on the continent managers, coaches will be asked more probing questions about their idea, about the training, about the football, about the strategy, about substitution. And you talked about Gary experiencing that at Valencia. And listen, I was at some of those press conferences. It got very heated, but they were asking, why are you here, or why are you English? Why did you do that? Now, it's the manager or the coach's job to get things right. I was speaking to Luis Enrique yesterday. He said, I'm here in a no excuses situation. He said, we're here to win. Yeah, playing well against Germany, 6-9. There's no excuses in my vocabulary. We have to win tournaments. So that's very good. So the responsibility lies there. But you've talked about not wanting to criticise a manager. And I've found that in my lifetime in British football, as an institution in British football journalism, the criticism that comes from journalism is often too personal. And in football, I think there's a culture where it's too irregular for good minds like yours, like Gary, like Terry Henry, not Terry's French, but there is a culture in Britain about if you say something that's contrary to what you've experienced or what you there's a preference for speaking euphemisms or maybe burying a criticism, because we're quite a warlike culture. If you criticise somebody, it's calling out, let's write it all off. And I'm like that. But what you learn is debate like that, where you're critical at the time or now, it opens up the debate. It helps change the culture. I don't think that we're particularly healthy in the fact that you'll have footballers of knowledge and worth within a club or within an international team during our lifetime. I'm much older than you, but whereby they'll say things in private and they won't say them in public, or they won't say them to journalists, because to criticise is wrong. Whereas in other cultures, it doesn't make them better or clever, but it is different, it's worth learning from. These types of criticisms that you might have offered back then, I think, because we've interviewed Sven in this podcast, I think when he managed Mancini and their ilk on Mihailovic or Veron, they came to him and went, manager, what's this? He talked about a big bust-up he had with a 20-year-old Clarence Seedorf who came in at Sampdoria. This is rubbish. And he went, okay. And so I worry about whether in a culturally, I don't mean you, but culturally, I think we're too slow to have at it.
I think you're right. And I don't know if it was something to do with being brought up with Liverpool, and it was almost, you know, being humble, you never get too carried away. And I always remember Pepe Reina saying to me, it wasn't so much about the manager. It was when we were having problems as a club off the pitch with American owners. And he said, because obviously it was seen as me and Steven Gerrard are the two most powerful players, if you like, and had huge influence. But in reality, we'd never be critical of anyone at the club. We were always very supportive of the club, even if it was bad. And he was saying, players in your position, this was Pepe Reina to me and Steve, he said, they'd be causing trouble. They'd be out in the press criticising this. It just, he said, in England, everyone's so humble and everyone's so supportive of their own club. He said, this would not happen abroad, really. And that was another thing when Rafa came as a manager as well, was that he would be quite openly critical of his chief executive, of his owner. Whereas we'd be like aghast, could not believe he'd said these things. I'm like, this is not the Liverpool way. This is not the way we do it here. And not necessarily England. More, I was always on the Liverpool hat on. And it was like, you don't criticise people you work with. You don't do this. But maybe, you know, what you're saying is maybe we're the ones who should be looking at ourselves a lot more. And not so much be critical, but maybe analyse a little bit more. Push, probe, get, you know, find more answers.
I think so, because the resources that you've become to football, you and your group, people of your quality, is now super clear. Beyond just winning, now your analysis is helping change the shape of the British game. Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true. Graham Hunter, and Backpage. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Here endeth the lesson.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. You've had enough staying home. You've had enough confinement. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds, like the breathable, silky, smooth tree runner, the responsive foam and extra grip of the tree dasher, or the classic low-top look of the tree piper. Allbirds has a shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Whether you're traveling to the ends of the earth or settling in for a staycation, you need a shoe that's versatile enough to go with any outfit, durable enough to wear over any terrain, and lightweight enough to make packing a breeze. Being made from insanely comfortable, breezy eucalyptus fiber is a plus, too. When you wear Allbirds tree shoes, you're in vacation mode before you even leave the house. They're the only shoes your suitcase needs. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair of tree dashers, runners, pipers, and more at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.